Well, hello everyone. Happy Friday. I'm Rita McGrath. You probably knew that. And I am actually here by the fireside because it is cold where I am and there's snow on the ground and it's looking very white Christmassy out there. Thank you so much for joining us, spending some time with us. My guest this week is Bob Sutton. And one of the things we want to make sure we talk about is his great new book, just got here. It's called The Friction Project. It is a labor of love. He's been working on it for 7 years. And we're going to explore some of the implications of the book. So welcome, Bob.
Oh, it's great to talk to you again, Rita. And I
It's
love your fire. It looks beautiful.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah, I literally by the fireside. So I love to explore some of the themes in the book. And one of the things that I think is particularly valuable about it is its nuance. And by that, I mean, you know, it's not all one thing or the other. You know, it sort of says under certain circumstances,
right,
the right actions to take, and under other circumstances, they're not. And so I'd love to hear a little bit about the journey of this book, because you've been living with it for a long time.
Yeah, it's 7 years and you know, but some things take longer than others. It's just how life is. I did write a book on workplace assholes in between, but this has been my main focus. So the way it started was in 2014. So Huggy Rao and I had another book. It only took 5 years. This book, Scaling Up Excellence.
Great book.
And a lot of us, like our friend Chris Yeh and everything, we're obsessed with scaling here in Silicon Valley. Let's grow big. Wow, let's go fast. And along the way, we kept noticing that there were all these companies, and like we worked with Facebook, Google, Salesforce in the early days, when they moved so fast. And then as they got larger and more complex, it just got harder and harder to get things done. And I remember, you know, to use names, that people at Google used to joke about big company disease. Well, they are suffering from big company disease themselves now. So that was one sort of impetus. Like you, we do a lot of executive education. And when we bring it up, and Huggy's especially masterful at this, he'll run like a half an hour therapy session. It's just kind of mostly just bitching and complaining. It was really both entertaining and troubling. They'd say things like, I work in a frustration factory. It's like working at the airport. We have so many pilot studies that people just come. We have more pilots than American Airlines. That was all.
That's great. One of my favorite lines from the past was, new products don't get launched at IBM. They escape.
This game, well, yeah, that, well, we all know that, since we both have studied product development, that what happens is that they escape. I'm probably, my non-disclosure is over. One time I spent 2 weeks at Steelcase trying to understand the product development process, and they have a giant pyramid and everything. You know, they're supposed to do all their R&D, and we couldn't find any products that had ever made it through the product development process. Talk about friction. Literally, we just kept, well, actually did find one, but then the guy said, to quote him, it got so ruined by the process, I wouldn't take credit for that piece of shit. Because it got, you know, they just get ruined. Add this, add that. But then we said, how do you do product development? Well, sometimes things are so important that some senior executive says we don't have to have time to go through the product development process. So it's the same thing as you, that there'd be this whole friction-filled process, which apparently was to support the bureaucracy and all the jobs and all the politics. But the actual innovation happened outside of the pyramid in this case. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. And let's see how much trouble I get in for saying that. But it was an amazing lesson.
It is. Well, and one of the things that I think is very nuanced about the book, right, is the recognition that, you know, organizations are messy. People are messy. And, you know,
yes,
like there's a great quote by somebody, one of your students, I think, who worked at Meta, who was reading all these articles about how, oh, go fast and break things in right, the close media. Like, gee, I wish I worked at a place like
yes,
that.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that about Meta. Unfortunately, you know, our friend Ed Catmull, this book, Creativity Incorporated, might be the best business book ever written. It would be at the top of my list. And I remember going to give a talk at Pixar and somebody saying, that's a great book. I wish I worked there. So it's like,
You can't escape
But
it, right? You
you gotta escape it. Yeah. So the other thing that got us going, and so they're sort of watching, if you will, other people suffer. But you and I both being parts of large bureaucratic universities, and I know stories about your university. I won't tell. I can tell you some about mine. That we noticed that the longer we were at Stanford, the harder and harder it got to get simple things done. And the other thing that happened is that, and it's correlated, is that we had more and more and more administrators. And there's been some reports recently, and it depends how you look at the data, but it kind of looks like we have the same number of administrators as students as we do at Stanford. It depends how you count, but it's the numbers are close. And just in my own little world, so I've been in the School of Engineering at Stanford for 40 years. When I first got here, we had one person who was a finance person, Ken Down. I remember exactly one. And we've only grown our faculty by about 20% since I've been here, our tenure track faculty. Now, there are so many finance people that even departments like mine, management, science, and engineering, have a little area that's where the finance people sit. And and yes, we probably need more finance people, but we don't need that many. And to me, that's a sign of friction. And also, one of the things that causes friction that we talk a lot about in the book is the notion that many organizations, this is certainly a problem with Google. Boy, I have so much inside information about Google because I keep having students get fired from them and they call me afterwards. Laid off, not fired, because they're doing a lot of layoffs. Essentially, from what I can tell at Google, like Stanford, the more people you have reporting to you, the more you get paid. And when you have an incentive system like that, it's a recipe for friction, because those people, especially administrators, they create work for other people's to justify their existence, and we've all lived with them. So
Absolutely.
that's kind of the bad news. The good news is that along the way, and we started out really pessimistic, I'll be honest. Oh, this is just all garbage, big dumb company disease. But then as the project continued, we kept running to all these people who made things better. So that's the good news. And then we also talked about things that ought to be hard and ought to be slow. So that's the optimistic part of the book, but the grumpiness got us going, being angry.
Well, you got to start somewhere, right? So one of the things that I was particularly taken with in the book is throughout, you talk about people not in an individual context, but you talk about the approach of friction fixers as being very thoughtful about the time and energy of other people. And really leaning into that and, making the things that ought to be easier and making the things that really should be a little harder, harder. And you talk about one of the example of Theranos, a military provision or not allowing those machines to be put on,
Oh,
emergency
so let's talk about Theranos, because Theranos is a really interesting example, because it was a case where Elizabeth Holmes and her team, and sometimes this is also a hallmark of feeling overly privileged, they really did act like the rules didn't apply to them. And the story we talk about in the book, very well documented, is that at one point she wanted to put that testing machine on U.S. Army helicopters. And it hadn't gone through FDA approval. And she had General Mad Dog Mattis pushing for it and everything. But in the end, the folks in the Army said, no, you can't get on, put them on the helicopter because it didn't go through FDA approval. So she thought it should be a frictionless process. But then there was a very brave lieutenant colonel who also was a PhD scientist who stopped her, and he had to fly down and meet with Mattis. And even Mattis, who initially wanted to sort of like put pressure on this guy to have him put it on the helicopter, even Mattis finally agreed that that's what the rules were. And a contrary case, just to show that not all of our Stanford students are dropouts and are terrible people. And we talk about this a little bit in the book, but I really want to underline it. There's two women in the book. Greta Meyer and Amanda Calabrese, they started a company called Sequel at Stanford. They actually took every entrepreneurship class together. Sequel is reinventing the modern tampon so it leaks less. They're both student athletes. And talk about a market, talk about a real problem. And they took all the entrepreneurship classes. They graduated. They're not dropouts. They just got FDA approval for their product, and they're working on, hopefully they're going to be enormously successful with Procter and Gamble and companies like that. There's a lot of market forces against them. But I was just talking to Greta, the CEO, last week, and she said, yes, we're very proud of the fact that we have reinvented a product that really hasn't changed in 80 years. That's her line. So I don't know that's true, but it's a good line. But the point I want to make about what Greta and Amanda did was they slowed down. I mean, their product got held up for a year and a half getting FDA approval, and I think it's glad I'm happy that it has FDA approval. So anyways, there are times you got to, if you will, hit the brakes so you can go faster later and not be unethical either.
Right. And you talk, one of the examples you use in the book is the case of BHP. Just in terrible situation, and the new CEO comes in, and everybody, of course, wants him to take immediate action. And he says, we're not doing anything right now.
I love that because like he's a turnaround expert, Paul Anderson, and he says we are not doing anything today. But so he's interesting because, and a lot of this goes back to one of our, in the behavioral sciences, intellectual heroes, Daniel Kahneman. Daniel Kahneman, his book about fast and slow basically makes the argument when you know what to do, it's fine to go fast, but when you're in a cognitive minefield, when you're confused, when things are messed up, that's when you sort of slow down and figure out what's going on. So what Paul Anderson did, amazing. So BHP, Broken Hill Property, used to be called whatever, it's the largest mining company in the world. It's just enormous. And they were losing a lot of money, about $1 billion a year. And they brought in this American, Paul Anderson, a very experienced executive. He'd been CEO of Duke Energy and stuff. And his theory was he was going to get a little memo from each of the top 80 people. What's your job? What would you do if you were me? Things like that. And then he talked to all of them, and then he figured out what to do, and including firing some of them, by the way. So I mean, that's what happens when you're in the top 80. But I sort of like that analogy of sort of like the gas and the brakes. That's one we've been using a little bit more. That even the best race car drivers, they know when to hit the gas, they know when to hit the brakes, and they know when to take a pit stop. And they also know when to quit because the car won't work anymore. So I think a lot of organizational life has an analogy to that.
So in the book, you talk about our human tendency to always add. Add on rather than think at the same time about subtraction. And there's a kind of a radical proposal that, you take everything you're doing, meetings, emails, notes, whatever, and reduce it by 50%.
Oh, that the rule of half. So let me. So this, I can't. This is Leidy Klotz. He wrote this book, Subtract. He's an amazing guy. I just love Leidy Klotz. And he and Gabriel Adams at University of Virginia, they did a whole bunch of research. Everything from how to fix a university, how to fix a Lego model, how to plan a European vacation, and they found that with every iteration, people would add more and more stuff. Nobody ever subtracted stuff unless you cued them. And if you cued people, got them to stop, maybe gave them a reward for subtraction, it actually worked. And so one of the things that Leidy and I have proposed, and by the way, we wrote this in an article for Higher Education, is suppose whatever we did, we just applied the rule of halves and cut 50%. And so just since we're in the same world, I've been proposing this to my dean, and I'm not completely failing, because so I've led many promotion committees, and Rita and I will not go through what it takes to get somebody tenured in a major university. But you just can't believe it is so easy to hire a lawyer who gets paid more than a professor at Stanford. My wife's a lawyer. We all know the head lawyer, Debbie Zumwalt. It's not that hard to hire a $500,000 lawyer at Stanford. But to promote an assistant professor who's maybe making $200,000 a year to the next level, I just led one of these cases. Her name's Melissa Valentine, 113 page document that was revised over and over again. We had 27 letters of recommendation, and I said to my dean, suppose we had done half the work and it was half the length, would it have changed anything? And by the way, As one of my colleagues said, this was one of the easiest tenure cases in history because she had such a strong case. This was not like a lot. It was just everybody said she could teach great. She's a great researcher. It was not a hard case. And so we are starting to have some talks, for example, about reducing the number of letters of recommendation. The best case I know of the rule of halves where it was actually applied is some of the folks in the audience may know Rob Cross. Rob Cross does stuff on social network analysis. Great new book on micro stress with Karen Dillon. I don't know if you've talked to him. I'm just a huge fan of Rob Cross.
Yeah,
He,
they've been on the fireside. We've had
oh, they're wonderful. And Rob, and they're, you know, Karen has just a history of doing great writing. And then Rob Cross he's been studying social networks for 35 years that I know of and great in great research. So in this example's in the book. So there was a very senior executive who was called Scott, who we talk about in the book, and this is straight from Rob. And Scott was suffering from, he had about 5,000 people reporting to him. So this is a lot of people. And he was suffering from massive overload. And he had this philosophy of, I'm going to have this huge top management team. He had 19 people. And he thought that every decision he should be involved in. And he was just, and then there were surveys, which Rob did, where something like 25% of the people at the next level below him were saying, maybe more than that, were saying that they were having trouble getting their work done because they couldn't get enough of Scott's time. So this is a job just designed to overload poor Scott. And he worked with Scott to cut his top management team in half, to remove him from things. And it looks like he cut it by about 50%. So I just had a Zoom with Rob last week and I was like, so did Scott really cut it by about 50%? And he said, yeah. Said, yeah, that was our aim and we pretty much achieved it. So that's a guy whose life, and I'm not saying this is always possible, but to us, when you're going to do the subtraction, starting out with the rule of halves as a goal or a hypothesis might help some people.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so you talk about sort of the principles of friction fixers. And I liked that the three sort of premises that you start the book off with. So I'm accountable and so are you. I'm a trustee of how people spend their time.
Yep.
And friction fixing is a craft. And I thought that was interesting. And you point out in the book that so often we punish sins of commission. We don't punish sins of omission.
Right.
You never get credit for the problem that never comes up. You get credit for fixing a problem that's happened. And yet friction fixers seem to manage to not let that happen.
Well, so yes, they do. And since both of us, we lived through the quality movement. And that, I mean, this is one of the main lessons in the quality movement. And believe me, not all the ideas in this book are original. In fact, most business ideas are not original. They're just repackaged in different forms. And that would include this book. And from the quality movement, there was all this sort of notion, what's the idea that nobody ever gets credit for a problem that never happened? And to me, that's a principle of what good design is that what good friction fixers do is that there are people who stop, who nip problems in the bud, design systems that are less likely to fail. And one of the things that I've gotten, we talk about in the book, and I've gotten even more obsessed with it since the book came out, is that this idea of maintenance, maintenance is not something that is particularly celebrated in the United States. In many cases, Silicon Valley, it's just, all come up with new ideas, blah, blah, blah. But without maintenance, nothing works. Life's really messy. It's like one of the examples of maintenance that we talk about in the book is the garbage collectors in New York City. Without garbage collectors, New York City would be hell. So in San Francisco. So that's one of those sort of people who I think that we need to celebrate more. There's a brand new book coming out on maintenance that's free online. And I'll send your readers a little link about that. I'm trying to remember who did it. Anyways, but to us, that's just an idea that comes from the quality movement that should never die, that maintenance is important.
Absolutely. So for those of you who are just joining us, I'm here with Bob Sutton of Stanford, who has the co-authored with Huggy Rao a great new book called The Friction Project. And you really get into the notion that what really great organizational designs do is they make the stuff that should be easy, easy, and they make the stuff that should be difficult, that you should take your time over,
Right.
harder. And maybe give us a high-level overview of what distinguishes between the two.
So some of the and I like the fact that you use the word craft, that but I think that both of us are attached to the idea of evidence-based management. I wrote a book on evidence-based management with Jeff Effer, but even in that book, Jeff and I argued that the kind of demands that leaders have on their time, they're so focused on particular contexts, and there's so much uncertainty that that evidence can help you make better decisions, but in the end, it's a craft, and nobody's batting a thousand. So I just always start that out, that I don't believe that there's no cure-alls, but some of the criteria that we look for, I already mentioned one. One is this idea from Danny Kahneman is, are you in a cognitive minefield? Are people confused? Are things all messed up? In that case, unless there's an absolute emergency, slowing down and figuring out what's going on. This to me is the hallmark of what a good leader, a good team does. The other one, and this is stolen from Jeff Bezos himself, he talks about one-way doors versus two-way doors. And the question is, you're like a strategy professor. You know this stuff much better than I do. This is the question of is it a reversible change or not? So and Bezos, it depends on the size of the organization. For Amazon, releasing another product like the phone, well, the phone wasn't successful, but that just was not a very, very high percentage of Amazon's worth. Okay, so the phone, he wasn't upset about that failure at all. That's just part of doing business. But so that would be a two-way door. But sometimes when it's a one-way door, you've got to be careful. So if you're selling your company, if you're doing a huge acquisition, maybe firing your CEO. So speaking of which, we should talk about this a little bit, because the decision to fire Sam Altman is at OpenAI. I don't know about you, but I still am marveling at because to use the one-way, two-way door analogy, well, when the board fired Sam Altman for whatever sins he committed, which I couldn't figure out what sins he ever committed, actually. They fired him in OpenAI. They thought this was a one-way door for him, but what it turned out to be, it was a two-way door for him, because they brought him back in about 4 days, and it was a one-way door for them. They all got fired, and so to me, I think that's a case of they didn't do step one. They were in a cognitive minefield. They didn't sort of slow down and figure out what was going on. And one thing they didn't do, just for firing people, would be an example of this. Since unfortunately, I know a lot of people have fired a lot of people, including my wife, who's a retired CEO, and her perspective is, if you're going to fire somebody, the first thing you do, and she's fired a lot of people, is that you figure out everybody they're attached to, and you cool them out before, because otherwise they can build a coalition to push back against you, and that's the she learned that, by the way, when she was running a large law firm and fired a lot of high testosterone men, and so she's very good at dealing with difficult men, and so that sort of understanding, they didn't do any of that at all. So that's two. Oh, and then I got to talk about two other things. One is creative work. So you and I both, we were all into creativity. There may be ways to make creativity less inefficient. It is such a fundamentally inefficient process. And I already mentioned Ed Catmull from the years of talking with Ed Catmull. I mean, so just as an example, he had some variation of a company that was trying to make computer-based digitized films for about 20 something years before Pixar was ever a success. That was a lot of R&D, and his perspective on the Pixar process, which was better when he was running it, he's not there anymore, and I see they're having trouble. It's not all because of him. Is that, yes, we would try to be efficient, but we didn't think about efficiency. We just iterated over and over and over again until it was right. And my favorite story, which is in the book and stolen from the Harvard Business Review, so the and this is the most bizarre interview. So Harvard Business Review interviews the comedian Jerry Seinfeld. I don't know if you saw this, but this is like one of the most fish out of water stories I've ever seen. So they ask him, they said, so you and Larry David had this really inefficient, painful, actually conflict-filled process where you produce the show. If you hired McKinsey, could they have made the process more efficient? Jerry Seinfeld says, who's McKinsey? He doesn't know who McKinsey is, which I think is to his credit. They explain who it is, and then he says, are they funny? No, they're not funny. And then he said, the easy way is the wrong way. When it comes to creativity, it's difficult. And if you look at his own process where he develops jokes for a stand-up routine, he will keep two or three out of every 100 jokes that he tries. And so that's one. And yes, there are times we all know this when creativity gets stalled. There's things you can do to speed it up. But Teresa Mabley, who I believe is the greatest creativity researcher who's ever lived, she's been studying creativity for 50 years. Yeah, I think she finished her PhD at Stanford about 50 years ago on creativity. She fundamentally, her research shows is, and when you put creativity under the gun and try to speed it up too much, what happens is that you just get less creativity and a lot of burned out people. And so that's one area that we look at. And then and there's like a zillion of these in the book, but I'm going to zoom on one that we should have touched on more in the book. So it's always, I guess the last version of the book was November 6th. Okay. So if I had one more week, this is what I would add. I got obsessed. I even got a paper here with this research on savoring. Okay. So there's all this stuff in academia and psychology that, oh, life's hard and we've got to cope with all of the setbacks. And yes, all that stuff is true. All of us have experienced deaths and other forms of terrible loss in our life. It's just part of the human condition. So that's coping. But there's sort of a bright side, which is savoring, which is that there's things in life that are wonderful. It's the awe of nature, having a beautiful meal, just, holding someone you love. It's all these sort of things in life that we can anticipate, we can slow down and enjoy. And that's a real, and if you want to be really tacky about organizational design, if you go to a 2 or 3-star Michelin restaurant and they rush you through the process, that's not right. Because you want to sort of savor the experience. So I got quite obsessed with the savoring stuff. And we do talk about it a little bit in the book. There's a guy named Fred Bryant who's got a book on savoring. He's been studying this forever. So we're stealing his ideas. But my favorite example of organizational savoring and being structured is that the largest supermarket chain in the Netherlands and Holland, it's called Jumbo. And there's a movement in Holland, sort of a national movement, where people are concerned about loneliness among the elderly. And one of the owners, it's a family-owned company, is involved in that movement. And so what they thought they would try, since supermarkets are one of the places that older people go, is they tried something like a chat lane or a slow lane, where when you got in the lane and you checked out your groceries, you knew you were getting in a line where the people in front of you were each going to have a 5-minute or so conversation with the clerk. So they tried one, and just for we have a Wall Street Journal piece coming out on January 29th, so related to the book. So they actually we had in the book, but our editor there, great editor, and Larry Rout did straight fact checking with them. And they say that after they tried it in one store, by the end of 2023, they had it in 200 stores. So it's been scaled. And it may be, like I love talking about savoring, but I don't know about you, but when I go to the grocery store, I want to get in and out. But to me, that's a sign where you've got, if you will, high and low friction in the same store. Because I think that they also have, the checkout where you can sort of scan it too for people who want to sort of rush out. So, but that's one of the things that just as I say, I almost want to have like another chapter on savoring. So that's one of the things that is another example of adding friction or slowing down.
I love that. I love that. We have a question from Joanna Barsh
Oh, I know Joanna Barsh. Hi, Joanna.
about mindfulness versus savoring and how those are related.
Well, Joanna, I could tell stories about Joanna. Anyways, so I would ask her if she's still living on the farm. So anyway, so I think they're the same thing. Right? They're variations of the same thing. But so Joanna, I guess she said yes, she's still on the farm. So I remember she was a McKinsey partner and lived on a farm. So anyway, yes, I think they're the same as mindfulness, but sometimes it could be mindfulness where you're just being alert about something going wrong. So and sometimes it's necessary to be vigilant. So I actually don't want my airplane pilot or surgeon doing too much savoring, to be honest. I want them to do things in a sort of maybe mindful sort of way, but to me it's mindfulness that's especially focused on being mindful about the joys and good things in life and not being paranoid about what's going to go wrong. And once again, we as human beings, we need to kind of do both. I do want people to be mindful and paranoid when they're landing the airplane, for example. That would be an example where I don't want too much savoring.
I love that. So you
Hi,
talked about a
Joanna.
couple of sources of why bad friction builds up. And one of my favorite chapters is the one on oblivious leaders. Maybe just because it draws so much on your previous books on leaders who are real jerks. But the ones who just surround themselves with bubble wrap and just don't want to see what's actually going on. And maybe talk about that a little bit.
Well, so I always, when it comes to leaders, especially senior leaders, I'm kind of always of two minds. One is that I kind of they kind of annoy me, but if I look at their jobs objectively, there's just a whole bunch of things that happen that lead them to be detached from understanding what's going on in their organizations. And I think the good ones understand that, and the bad ones suffer from what we call in the book the fallacy of centrality. I'm the CEO. I know what's going on in my company. Well, almost, there's all these things when you're the CEO that cause you not to know what's going on in your company. A lot of good evidence, Elon Musk is an extreme case, but there's a lot of good evidence that that people learn not to give the CEO bad news because there's the shoot the messenger problem. Even CEOs who say, I've created a psychologically safe environment, all of our friend Amy Edmondson, and it's safe to speak up here. Well, even those CEOs, they tend to be more happy to see the people who give them good news rather than bad news. And this is very well documented. And then another thing that happens, and these are just things, if you're in power, these things are going to happen to you. And it's not a death sentence or whatever, but you've got to fight it. It's not guaranteed. The other one is that there's privilege that often comes with being in power, that you may not have to go through certain lines, or maybe your assistant is bringing you lunch, or as happens in some of those New York City banks, you get your own elevator so that you don't have to wait in the elevator with the unwashed masses. Your executive vice president's only getting paid $5 million a year or whatever. You don't have to get in the elevator with them, and so there's a whole bunch of things that lead CEOs, especially quite powerful people, and this can happen in smaller groups too, to just not be aware of what's going on. And some of it is also just the math of the pyramid of an organization. There's kind of you and there's thousands of people. There's no way in a big organization you can know everything that's going on. So there's a whole bunch of things that happen to leaders that risk them being oblivious. One of my favorite ones that I would pick, and I'll just choose one, is there's a big literature, and probably everybody in this call has heard of resistance to change. And yes, there is resistance to change. I mean, we're all interested in resistance to change, but there's another side of this equation, which the late great James March, who I had the privilege of writing an article with, if he J Jim March, for people who don't know, probably one of the two or three greatest ever living organizational theorists, a remarkable career and so playful. He just loved to drink wine. And I wrote an article with him. He said, well, we'll just drink wine for a year and maybe an article will come out. And that's what we did. And I was like, this is not my normal process, because I was like newly tenured and was like, where are we supposed to suffer? So one of the things that Jim talked about in a classic paper, Footnotes to Organizational Change, is the notion that while senior leaders talk about resistance to change, often the opposite happens, which is that people interpret weak signals from them and have much stronger responses than they ever intended. And I, we've got a whole story about 7-Eleven and a whole courtesy campaign that they started that was just resulted from a temper tantrum that the CEO had, and he was amazed to discover. Years later, the company has spent millions on courtesy in 7-Eleven stores. That was some of my early research. And it was pretty funny because in his second temper tantrum he had when he found out about it at the end of the program, he said, "Why are we spending all this money on courtesy? Nobody goes to a 7-Eleven store for courtesy. They just want to get in and out fast with nothing bad happening. That's all they want," which is the research, some of which I was involved in. That's what we established. And this idea of sort of magnification is something that is quite interesting to us. And the funny example we use in the book was I once met the executive assistant for a Fortune 10 CEO, and she told me the blueberry muffin problem. So she starts working for this guy, and the very first meeting she goes to with him, he just comments, "It's a breakfast meeting. Where are the blueberry muffins?" It's just an offhand comment. So she put in the notes, "Must have blueberry muffins," because wherever you go, there's a CEO, there's a set of notes. And he couldn't figure out for years, wherever he went, there was huge piles of blueberry muffins. And he didn't even like them that much. It was just an offhand comment. And to me, that's an example of just sort of being oblivious to this idea of magnification, of magnification. And that's just one little example. But to us, what great leaders do is that they find ways to be in tune with what's going on around them. And we have lots of ideas in the book. One of my favorite ones, and there's things like shadowing people and doing the work, all the classic sort of stuff. One of my favorite ones, which actually I don't even think we put in the book, is I once met a CEO, and she said that her philosophy in every job she took was to find the person in the office who was like the gossip, office gossip, who just was always spewing dirt about it. And she said, "Every place I've ever been, you know who that person is. And generally, the CEO stays away from them." And she said, "So I would become friends with that person so I could get the dirt from her." And I thought that was brilliant. And then the other thing she said, and this is the sneaky part of this, was when you become friends with that person, you can change the narrative because they will say, "Well, Anne says," and you can sort of push back. And I thought that was one of the more smart leadership acts, because our natural tendency in life is to stay away from, unpleasant people who are always spewing out nasty gossip. So.
So one of the things I really liked in the book is how you talk about people who are both the bearers of friction and sort of the enforcers of friction, but that you have to get, I think you said, six layers down. From like those people, and then we have stereotypes about them, right? Like oh, the bureaucrats, the people who are just,
Yes.
and yet most of the time, they care about their constituents, they care about their jobs, they would like it to go better, they see how stupid it all is, and yet they either don't feel empowered, or they don't feel they have the right, or they're being blocked from making the changes that they know would benefit everybody.
Yeah, so this is the L6 strategy, and the person who is kind of famous for popularizing it, his name is Todd Park. And what Todd Park is most famous for, I interviewed him twice, the most electric guy I've almost ever talked to. So he and his brother Ed started a company called Athena Health, a software company. They sold it, and then now they're running something called Devoted Health. And the idea of Devoted Health is to improve the quality of well, for like people like me over 65, the quality of the healthcare experience. So it's less stressful and less fragmented. But in between, Todd was the CTO for the White House right when Obamacare, the Obamacare website came up. And just for those of you who don't remember, and some of you are in other countries, when our sort of semi-nationalized healthcare system came in the Obamacare website, there was this key sort of exchange you could go to. Well, the website was so bad that when you clicked on it, there'd be an 8-second delay between each click. It was really bad. So Todd Park, he's a Silicon Valley sort of hotshot type. He comes in and he's got two kinds of people. He's got sort of fellows from places like Google and Facebook, sort of hotshots, and he's got these frontline contractors. And so what he does is he uses a strategy, said, to figure out what's going on, you got to go down to the sixth level. the people, and he said when he talked to people who were involved in implementing the Obamacare website, the people at level two or three, they had no idea what was going on. So he got down to the people who were on the front lines, and one of the things that came out of that, and if you think about many problems where there's friction, very often there's fragmentation, which means that there's, and we talk about this, there's different pieces of the system. All of them might work okay, but they don't quite fit together well. And what he and the Silicon Valley hotshots figured out was that they had great pieces of the system, just there wasn't very good integration in terms of information, or what I think this, don't the software people call this interoperability? I may be getting that wrong. Anyhow, so he had them work together to sort of solve that problem, but the people at the top didn't help him at all. And this idea of understanding what's going on where the work actually has been done, this is not a new idea, is as critical as many of us may be of Frederick Winslow Taylor's work. If you read the book about Taylor, one of the reasons that he was able to come up with so much stuff that improved the quality of the work on the shop floor was he worked on the shop floor with those folks. So that's like a long-standing tradition, and yet many executives don't actually understand how the work is being done on the front lines.
I think that's absolutely true. One of the things that I always talk about is, as a senior leader, right? You need that input from the edges, and you need to be able to be, I call it being discovery driven. In other words,
Yes.
you uncover something that's important, you need to be able to say, "Hey, this has changed my assumptions about the world. Now I need to switch gears," or whatever it is, and I'm sort of socialized into not doing that.
Well, I think sometimes it's uncomfortable. There's a guy, and at first I found a story about him online, and then I contacted him. So he was a Disney executive, and one of his jobs was to run something called the All-Star Resort in Florida, which is the largest Disney resort. And if you think about the largest Disney resort, there's a lot of housekeeping to be done, right? So we're back to maintenance and how important maintenance is. And so what he did was he said he spent 2 weeks working alongside the best housekeepers. And he said they actually use different practices than the other ones. Just for example, there's certain things that don't need to be done every day when you clean a hotel room, like clean the mirrors or something like that, and or certain kinds of dusting. And he said they would tend to sort of make Tuesday's mirrors or Wednesday's dusting and stuff like that. And then after working along, and he also said they had different ways to make beds that they taught him that was more efficient. And so then he worked on them and had them spread the best practices throughout. The thing is called the All-Star Resort. I think he said it had 6,000 rooms, something like that. And to me, that's an example of getting on the front lines. And yes, that isn't enough. If there's senior executives here, that often isn't enough. We all know the classic case of somebody who was sort of like the classic thing in a sports analogy. There are some great athletes who should never be in leadership positions because they're missing other things. But to me, so that's necessary, but not sufficient.
Yeah, I would agree. Another thing that I really liked about the book is, and I think this is where a lot of management books go wrong because they look at like everything's there's a single answer for everything. But you talk about chaos Muppets versus order Muppets, grease people or gunk people, and how you put them in the right roles. And I love that because it's so like you could like if you just conjure up the circle of people that are in your networks, I can very quickly say, "Oh yeah, gunk, grease, order,
Oh,
chaos."
yeah, we all know.
Right? But what I love about it is there's a place for gunk, right? I mean, there's a place where you want things to be done exactly the way they
Yeah,
are.
oh, yeah. So, I mean, the people, it's rule. It's basically people who are wired to sort of follow rules and make rules, and people who are wired to break them and find ways around them. And we all know, we all know those sort of people, and people who are too anal, excuse my language, about following them. Sometimes it's a problem, but then sometimes the rules are in the way. And it's just a little example of in the book that there was one guy, and this is again where it gets back to maintenance. He was a city worker who was studied by a researcher who studies municipality rules. And one way that he broke rules was that he would drive around with a truck full of, what do you call it, like
Asphalt.
But yeah, thank you. You've got asphalt to fill holes. And he would do unauthorized hole filling on streets that he wasn't allowed to. And he could get in trouble for that. Now, that's a really constructive sort of rule follower, a rule breaker. And if you look at, people like Steve Jobs, well, Elon Musk pushes my buttons a little bit too far. Very often people who are innovators do break a lot of rules and then do sort of clean up things later. And we know Uber, we have a case on Uber, and we had a fair amount of involvement with them early. A lot of what their business model was breaking the rules in the country, breaking the rules in San Francisco, and then trying to do the litigation later. And I'm not defending them doing that, but without that sort of Travis perspective of we're just going to go, 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 and then we're going to sort of clean things up later, I don't think there'd be an Uber. But now eventually you get to the point where you're legitimate enough and you've got to sort of follow the rules too. So there's sort of a life cycle.
Well,
But yeah, to your point, I want an airplane pilot who follows the rules, just as an example.
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, our mutual friend Jeff Pfeffer talks about, you learn the rules, right? Then you break the rules, and then you make the rules when you're thinking of a power trajectory, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's classic Pfeffer. Yes. Yeah. I'm very good friends with Jeff. I wrote two books with him. I think personally, Jeff is really good at figuring out the rules and breaking them. He's not very good at in making them. He's very good at breaking rules.
So in sort of the latter part of the book, and this I think is quite interesting, is a real emphasis on civility, caring, and love, really helping people operate together in better ways. And what it made me think of was so often when we look at sludge-filled systems or systems that are, is that Cass Sunstein's word? I think it is,
Yeah, sludge.
unnecessary sludge, right, in things. And we sort of feel sorry, out of control, disempowered, or whatever. And yet we can all do those things, right? We can all be civil to each other. We can all
Right.
exhibit a sense of compassion and caring. And I think one of the things that is so interesting about the book is that you don't separate out those emotions from the functioning of the organization. You see it as an essential part of how human organizations work. So how do we reinforce those things?
I mean, just to sort of back up, we learned this. Well, the key researcher here, Seagal Barsad, passed away, the most wonderful person you ever met in your life. She did this research on companionate love, and what and first she initially in a nursing home, and then she did a larger scale study. And what Seagal's research showed was she used the word love, so sort of like non-romantic love that people have for one another, that when they feel that way in an organization, that their mental and physical health is better and they do better work, especially when there's human beings involved. And this idea of sort of caring and civility, you look at research on civility, when people recognize others as human beings, when they say hi to them, they stop and chat for a second. It's just basically civility is a social lubricant. That's sort of caring and civility. But back to Todd Park, and not that I'm enamored with Todd Park, but I'm very enamored with Todd Park. So I'm interviewing this guy, and I think he's like a hardcore. I mean, he's like really a capitalist. He's sold a software firm. He's got a new startup called Devoted Health, trying to. It's got a. They're in 13 states. And he spends the first 15 minutes talking about love. And I'm like, and I interrupted him three times. I said, okay, so you're a hardcore Silicon Valley executive, blah, 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 and you're talking about love. And he said, here's why. He said, our design principle for Devoted Health, and they're trying to have more one-stop shopping, because we all know in the US healthcare system, it's a story of friction and fragmentation, and trying to navigate it is very difficult. I'm just at the point, where my wife and I are sort of dealing with the sort of retirement stuff. She's a lawyer. I'm a professor. It is so hard, and I don't know how people don't who other people do it. So anyway, so the philosophy that Todd and his brother Ed have in Devoted Health is that when you have somebody on the other end of the line who's trying to get help from Devoted Health, you treat them with love, the same love you would have for your mother and father. And we start with that as a design principle. And then we work backwards to figure out, well, the software, the supply chain, the communication strategy. And so we said that's one of the reasons that although we do have online help available, that we actually have more human beings on the front line. And you in our goal, and I'd be curious to hear from customers, but he said that our goal is to never put you in a situation you're on a phone tree or you're on hold forever. Since we all know, when we use the example of Comcast, that seems to be their business strategy is to put you on hold and make it as difficult to talk to a human being as possible. But to go back to love, I really thought that was an interesting design principle, because if you started out with the notion, for our students, since we both like, what would their mother or father want for them? And I'm not talking about the ones who had like the crazy parents. I'm talking about the ones who have the same parents. What would their parents sort of want for them, or what would they want for themselves? So that it's funny because that's another thing that if we were going to revise the book, I'd have even more about love in it, because I got kind of obsessed with love. And savoring those are, I guess, more positive emotion things.
Very interesting. So if you're not the CEO, you're not the person making big structural changes, but you see instances of bad friction and you'd like to get rid of it. Where would you start? What would some advice be?
Ooh. So, well, first of all, it's hard not to have a conversation like this without using the term Amy Edmondson multiple times, since she's like one of our heroes. And I mean, there has to be enough psychological safety that this is possible. But to me, and this is one thing that Huggy really emphasizes in the process, is that a lot of times things don't get fixed in organizations in the moment or even longer term because it's an orphan problem. And people say it's everybody else's fault. So I would just sort of start with, look in the mirror, see if you can fix it. And I'll tell two quick stories. One
Oh,
is
you
about
gotta
the
tell
DM.
the chicken story. You gotta tell
Well,
the
no, I want
chicken.
to tell the DMV story. This is my favorite one. Well, I can tell the chicken heifer story. That's another story. That's right. But I'm going to tell one that happened more recently. But the DMV story is the thing that shocked me the most in the process of writing the book. And I just had to go to the DMV because my mother passed away and I had to deal with her car. And the California DMV, I allotted 3 hours to go through the process because it's used to be terrible. I got there at 7:30 in the morning. There's a long line. At 7:40, a gentleman walked out. I was about 60th in line. And he stopped, talked to every person, asked them what they were there for, gave some of them, he told them to get out of line. You can't get a passport at the California DMV. Some of them, he gave a form to fill out on the spot. And the rest of us, he gave us instructions about how to navigate through the system quickly. And he gave me a form to fill out soon. I was out by 8:20. The doors opened at 8. It was one of the best experiences. We have since been in touch. Huggy and I are talked to the leaders of the California Department of Motor Vehicles. They're doing a whole bunch of systematic things, and including empowering frontline workers, so that our experience and also a lot of technological solutions, so you don't have to come in the DMV in the first place, to improve the process. So that's my line, and I've been saying this to Stanford University and Google in the last 2 weeks. If the DMV can do it, you can do it. So that's sort of like my big sort of line. Anyway, you were going to say about the chicken effers. So I have this friend, and oh, she's just crazy. She's wonderful. Her name's Becky Margiotta. We've been writing cases about her for years. She went through West Point, U.S. Military Academy, and everything, and eventually left the military actually because she's gay, and it was during the Don't Ask, Don't Tell period, and she wasn't comfortable with that. She was looking for something to do. And eventually she got involved leading something called the 100,000 Homes Campaign, which found homes for 100,000 homeless Americans. And it was a national decentralized movement. We have a case about it. She was on 60 Minutes and everything. She's a total character. And now she's helping other folks and nonprofits spread good stuff. But what happened when she was in the military was when she went to see her commanding officer, and something was messed up, and she had to wake up her commanding officer in the middle of the night. She sort of looked up groggily and looked at Becky and said, "I'll censor this. Who's effing this chicken?" Which means who's responsible for fixing it? And that's sort of the military work. And so along the way, during the 100,000 Homes campaign, Becky started having trouble hitting her goals. And she realized that, as she put it, there were two kinds of people involved. One were what she called chocolate Easter bunnies. These were people who used talk as a substitute for action, who made promises and never did their things. And then there were people who actually did stuff. Those were the chicken effers. And she would give them a little metal rooster statue to sort of reward them for doing stuff. And I think the point here is that no matter where you are in an organization, understanding what your cone of friction is and how you can make things better or worse for others is important. And another example I'll give, I think I have a minute for this, is since you and I deal with a lot of executive education. So it's about 2 months ago. And so I was doing one of these things, which is both wonderful and terrible. So I'm doing a Zoom call with 400 senior executives from a large software firm. And one of the great methods that's in the book, and it's eminently scalable, is the subtraction game, where we put people in duos or in groups and have them talk about what's driving them crazy and what they should get rid of and do less of. And they come up with subtraction targets. So we do this, and the number one subtraction problem or thing was driving them crazy was too many Slack messages, too long, too irrelevant. So that was it. So then I said to them, "So you are 400 vice presidents in this big company. I suggest each of you look in the mirror and look at your Slack messages and try to eliminate and send fewer Slack messages, fewer irrelevant Slack messages, and shorter Slack messages." And I to me, that, and my little host, I got a little like love note with hearts from my host, because, and I'm guilty of that too. Rita knows me. I sometimes get excited and send emails that are way longer than they should be to way too many people. So I would plead guilty. I'm not perfect, but I think that the responsibility for it is, it's not just other people. When it works, we take accountability for ourselves.
Well, and I think part of the interesting thing about the book is you really go through how a lot of times these friction things, they seem to emerge, without anybody really being particularly strategic about them, right? They're perhaps a short-term reaction to a problem that is never going to occur again. I see this in innovation all the time, right? So somebody in 1982 had a problem, and now we're going to put in place a process to make sure that problem never occurs again. When in fact the cost of that process to make sure the thing never occurs again vastly exceeds what it would be if the problem happened again, right? And so these things kind of build up on, it's like
Well,
you're
I really like that example, because I could even talk about some of Stanford's accounting practices that reflect something that happened 30 years ago. And not only do you have the rule, you end up with a whole bureaucracy to support the rule. So there's 25 people's jobs who depend on making sure that the stupid, irrelevant rule is enforced, even though the cost of removing it would be trivial. So that's perfect. Yeah, that's a perfect example.
I've got a parallel example from my esteemed university. So it used to be if you had expenses to submit, you would put them on a piece of paper and, or a spreadsheet or something, and you would hand them into accounts or whatever.
Right.
And now we've got this system, which you're supposed to put in all this stuff yourself. So essentially what you're doing is you're taking, super highly paid
Right,
professionals
right.
and making them scan receipts and upload them into a system, when in the past you had a person who was probably, an hourly worker doing that work. And it's just like,
Well,
what?
that's so. Sometimes they call that robotic bureaucracy, and we all, and it does happen, because what happens, it's software, as a substitute for actually humans who help us. Yeah, we have the same thing. We
I'm
have the
sure.
same thing at Stanford. I think
And I'm
that.
not, I mean, I'm sure it was all done with great intentions, but the unintended consequences now, because it's connected to your university ID,
Oh, that's right. Well,
it's
I see
what.
people are also going crazy with Boeing. Yes. Boeing's definitely got some serious problems.
They really do. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to kind of wrap up here. So, for those of you that are still with us, the book is The Friction Project. My guest is Bob Sutton. And I have so enjoyed this conversation.
Oh,
So,
so fun.
where can people find more? I'm assuming you have a
Well,
website.
I just the easiest way to, I mean, I'm on Twitter and, or I guess it's X now, and LinkedIn, but bobsutton.net is probably the best site to find me. And it's so fun to talk to you, Rita.
Oh,
And
it's lovely to talk to you.
by the way, you're not only a good professor, you're a good student, because we've all been interviewed by a lot. You read the book much more carefully than almost anybody who's interviewed me. So thank you. I appreciate that.
I really enjoyed it. I want to come back. I mean, I had to read it quickly, but I want to come back to it for the my own, work that I'm doing here. So for those of you, I know there were a lot of questions in the chat. If we didn't get to them, live, I will transcribe them. And Bob, I'll send them over to you, and maybe you
Oh,
can
that's
do a little
wonderful. Thank you.
post wrap up.
Thank
Great. Well, thanks everybody. Have a
you.
great weekend. And if you're looking for something good to read, pick up the Friction Project.
And thanks everybody for joining us. Bye bye.